Lunch with Leon.
Hello and welcome to Lunch with Leon. And it's episode 98, which, by the way, is well beyond the life expectancy of many independent podcasts. So thanks for all of your support. We're on a bit of a run of bringing back guests from earlier episodes. But, you know, we've been doing this together now for over 4 years, so maybe that's okay. This week, my guest is Thomas Abelman. He was a guest in 2021, episode 33, if you want to go back to it. He has his own podcast, the Freewheeling Podcast, if you want to go and look for it wherever you get yours from. Well, Thomas, you've had a few years off being on air because you were at Transport for London as Innovation Director, a post that I'm proud to say that I created. You were the second incumbent for it. So what can you tell us about your time in TfL?
And it was the most wonderful, it is the most wonderful organisation with the most fantastic people I've ever worked with. And I genuinely mean that. I feel somewhat embarrassed because obviously I recruited my own team when I led a startup before joining TfL, who were also absolutely superb people. You join someone like TfL and the quality of leadership and management is absolutely fantastic, especially at that kind of, you know, TfL is a highly bureaucratic, highly sort of civil service style organization. It's all organized by bands like the civil service. And if you look at kind of what's called a band four level, which is the sort of senior middle management level, you've got this incredible group of people with this stunning strategic focus. And you can walk into a room and just have this incredible conversation about what needs to be done to facilitate the city in 30, 40 years' time. However, it is also, as I mentioned a moment ago, a very bureaucratic organization. And one of the missions that I had when I was at TfL was to try and help the organization recover some of that entrepreneurial, innovative spirit that had characterized it during the 2000s. And I spent quite a lot of time thinking about, you know, I mean, why is TfL less innovative now? Because I think it's fair to say it probably is. What has changed? And what does a corporate organization that is big and bureaucratic look like that also generates fast, agile change? And that was a fascinating question to be able to spend time thinking about.
I'm sure that is right. And a complication for it as an organization, of course, is it has all its legal responsibilities. And it is the arm of the mayor. But it's not just the arm of the mayor. It's probably one of the most powerful levers that he's got, because he's only got some control of the Metropolitan Police and he's only got some influence over the local authorities. But in the case of TfL, it's one very big lever, isn't it? And sometimes the organisation is the delivery agent for the mayor, and sometimes it's in its regulatory position. I guess I've always felt that when the mayor realises what a powerful organisation he's got, he or she has got, then it's got something it can really do. But if the mayor doesn't recognise that, then the organisation's ability to perform isn't as great as it might be. Is that fair?
It's a slightly bonkers organisation, TfL. I mean, you're absolutely right, because it's a direct operator in things like the London Underground and Dial a Ride. It's bus services and the DLR and the Overground operated what we now would call franchising, even if franchising bears no relationship to the word franchising used in any other business sector whatsoever, apart from Metropolitan Bus Services. I don't quite know how that happened. It's a regulator with very defined statutory responsibilities when it comes to cabs, private hire vehicles, coaches, on all of those things, as you say, have to interact together. And one of the things that I think is interesting to look at in TfL is almost it, not made a mistake, that's not quite fair, but I think it did something without quite realizing what it was doing. So I wasn't in TfL in the 2000s during this kind of real innovative period that it had, but a lot of the people who were are still there, because I've spoken to a lot of them while I was in there, and I also was a Londoner observing it from the outside. And almost by accident, when it was created in 2000, you had a whole bunch of different organizations bashed together and all given the ramble, but actually they had relatively discrete management teams, leadership, cultures. You know, the public carriage office now had the ramble on it, but it was a different beast to the DLR, which was a very different beast to the bus network and the Underground. And actually, there were some advantages to that, because, you know, if you look, and I have spent a lot of time looking at the characteristics of different organizations and their ability to deliver innovation and pace and agility, big is often the enemy. It's harder to get things done in big organizations. And to an extent, in the 2000s, TfL had a kind of benefit that it was a big organization. It had big firepower, big muscle to go and talk to the government, a big reputation. But actually, if you're running the DLR or you're running whatever it is, you've got the resources available to you. You can just get on and make it happen. And then TfL set off on this kind of gargantuan 15-year restructuring process to make itself what it was branded as, which is the world's most integrated transport authority. And it is now hyper integrated, and everything depends on everything else because it's pure matrix management, which is a very challenging style in which to operate if you are a public sector bureaucracy. And I don't think TfL has quite nailed how to be a hyper integrated public sector bureaucracy, even though that's kind of what it set out to be. And there are others who are trying to make this work, but it's a really tough mission.
I get that, because the danger in all this, of course, is that you get escalating corporate veto, which is you've got something you want to do, but you need at least five other people to think it needs doing as well before you can make any progress. And inevitably, that works its way. So decision-making goes up the organisation. And escalating corporate veto is terrible, because you do get people, and I'm talking generally here, not about TfL specifically, but generally you find somebody in this process who won't do it, in which case... Correct. If that person won't do it, nobody can do it. And that particular avenue of progress is lost to you. And I think that's the danger that I think big organisations always have, especially one where you are trying to integrate, in some cases, things that don't want to be integrated. And in the case of TfL, for example, the London Underground carries less people than the bus network, but it's a very much bigger organisation because it's all direct labour, whereas everything on buses is contracted out. So there's two things there where you're trying to integrate something, one with a very heavy direct labour workforce and heavily unionised, with something that's got no labour force at all. And I think you have to recognise sometimes that there's a point beyond which integration will not go. Otherwise, you've got a very unhappy average, which is something overspecified for one thing and not well enough specified for something else. That, for me, continues to be a worry, I think.
No, the escalating corporate veto point is absolutely right. And it doesn't, that implies, if you use that phrase, which is an accurate phrase, but it implies that this is sort of people being difficult. And it's often not people being difficult. It's just that over here, you have a department that has a series of priorities that it's been given because, and this is not really a comment on TfL, but it is true of TfL, but it's true of many, many organisations that operate in a traditional hierarchical environment but have attempted to create a matrix organisation below. It's still culturally hierarchical. Transport across the world emerged from this sort of relatively militaristic hierarchical world. So if you are over here and you run this department, then you take your guide from your boss, who takes the guide from their boss, and you have a set of priorities. Over there, you've got another department who've got their own set of priorities. And over there, you've got another department that have their own set of priorities. And they've all been set hierarchically down from the top. But of course, they've diverged into different projects by the time they meet people who are actually doing the work, which is fine if those are still relatively narrow, separate silos. Like the DLR is a silo and the buses is a silo. They can sort of drift off and do their own thing. There's disadvantages to that, but they can do that. Whereas what happens in a matrix style organization is over here, you have someone who's got their priorities. They only can get a certain way. They get 60% of their project done before they need another department to chip in resource. But that department has got its own priorities. So it's doing something else for which it can only get 60% of the way done, which depends on another department, which can only get... No one's vetoing, but no one's able to finish either. And you need a really sophisticated leadership approach. And one of the things I was doing while I was at TfL is looking around the world to see, where do you have corporates that have created this environment of matrix-style functional leadership, but have also been able to find ways of getting things done and avoiding the situation where everyone's depending on everyone else and nothing's actually being finished? Which, by the way, I don't want to be quite clear. I'm not saying that is how TfL works. Obviously, incredible things get finished at TfL. I'm saying in this kind of environment, that is the danger that you face. And it's one that you need to be very deliberate in trying to avoid.
Indeed, which of course is a wonderful segue into what you're doing now, because everything you've just described is what you're trying to unlock in your new business. But just before we leave the TfL point, you can imagine I'm glowing with pride that the post which I created and was originally inhabited by Michael Hurwitz and then by you has moved TfL's innovation catalogue away from trying to specify lightweight doors on the underground and moving into a global search for best practice in terms of organisational reform and organisation itself, stuff that's happening. And the thing that originally was the spark for this idea at all was the extent to which we in TFL in my time were completely derailed by Uber when it arrived without warning, and we didn't have the legislation or the policies or even the agreement between the parties as to how it should be dealt with. And one of the jobs, of course, in innovation was to be scouring the horizon for all the stuff that's coming at you and trying in some way to be prepared for it. And as far as I can tell, the rate at which unexpected things are coming at us can only increase. So I think so. Congratulations on a bit of the organisation that was designed to be the forward-looking radar set on maximum, and a move away from a sort of slightly engineering-led innovation thing, which wasn't really innovation at all. It was just development.
No, I couldn't agree more. One of the things I really was keen to do in that role, and I think that's one of the reasons why after I was there for a year, it became a director of strategy and innovation. We brought in the whole business planning, business strategy function, because innovation and business strategy should be the same thing to a very significant degree. And that's what it became for the next 2 years of my time there.
But that was moving us anyway into the fact that having suffered organisational arthritis and frustrations in the way that you have, your new venture is designed to help people do the opposite.
Yes, absolutely. So I what I realised when I was given this mission at TFL was that I was starting from a relatively good place, because throughout my career, I've kind of alternated corporate and highly entrepreneurial organizations. I did my graduate training at National Express, very traditional corporate. They're actually very devolved at that point. It's not now, but at the time it was a very devolved organization with every business given a lot of freedom and leeway. And I was part of the strategy team in National Express Coaches, which was run very independently from National Express Buses. And I really saw the advantage of that highly devolved model. But it was very much a traditional corporate. I had a fantastic time there and ended as product development director in Coaches. Then joined Chiltern Railways and spent 7 years as commercial director. And my Lord, Chiltern Railways was a very different environment. Yeah, this was in the days of Adrian Shooter as, he was chairman and MD and chairman and MD of the holding company as well. It was a phenomenally entrepreneurial business. During the 7 years that I was there, we doubled revenue. And I know Chiltern is not a huge train company, it really isn't, but equally, we took revenue from 100 million to 200 million, and adding 100 million to 100 million business is a tough thing to do in the transport sector. And we did that through huge amounts of innovation and change. Then I founded my own startup, which I led for 5 years until the pandemic, which is a digital marketplace platform. And then I joined TFL. So what have you got there? You've got Chiltern Railways, which was a highly entrepreneurial organization, but actually embedded in Deutsche Bahn, probably the largest, most bureaucratic transport corporate in Europe, possibly the world. You've got Snap, my startup, pure entrepreneurial organization, venture capital backed, where I spent a lot of time with many other VC-backed businesses, startups in a lot of different sectors, and then TFL, very traditional corporate. And what I realized from that was that, yes, there are some leadership and ways of thinking and decision-making processes that do not read across all three of those environments, but there are actually some that either can do or should. And that if you want to get things done faster and achieve that agility and pace of change, there are things that traditional corporates can learn from the entrepreneurial world. And basically what I'm trying to do with what I'm doing now through freewheeling is helping organizations that want to respond to what, as you said a moment ago, a rapidly increasing pace of change in the world out there. And one of the last things I spent some time on while I was at TFL was the challenges that AI is going to bring. It's not a question of exploiting opportunities. There are incredible opportunities, but just it's going to change the whole way customers interact with all organizations, ours not least. So the world of change is increasing. How we can respond to those and how we can use the lessons that more entrepreneurial organizations than ours have developed, the approaches they've developed in terms of decision-making, leadership, how they structure their organizations to maximize agility while still operating in an environment that you've got to mitigate risk.
I mean, that is so exciting. And in terms of your customers then, in terms of the people that you're reaching out to, these would typically be large organizations wanting to make change faster and respond to changes being imposed on them faster. Is that a fair summary?
Absolutely. So, and it's a whole range of different options. So one thing I've done is just gone in and run some workshops or management conferences. So I've delivered a session at one of the big global transport groups on lessons from entrepreneurial organizations, for their teams purely as a one-off. I'm working with a local authority on what they can do in terms of agility and increasing their pace of change. There's another transport group I'm talking to at the moment. So it doesn't have to be big organizations. It can be any. I'm working with a very small startup as well. But obviously, it's the kind of bigger organizations who typically have the most to learn in this environment. It doesn't have to be. And one of the things that it's worth remembering is, I think, some sort of medium-sized to large organizations can sometimes think, well, the way we do things is fixed. It has to be done this way. And if it's slow, it's slow, but there's nothing we can do about it. And I'm not pretending that things can be changed instantly and overnight, because it can't. But there is an alternative. You know, I spent quite a lot of time looking at Amazon, and I know a lot of people have challenges with elements of Amazon's business model, and I'm not going to get into that. But what they have done is shown how a corporate, which is a big operator, they are the biggest transport operator on earth, just in terms of the things that in our world, never mind all the other things they do, in our world, they have more drivers, more depots, more vehicles than any of us. So they're the biggest transport operator on earth. How have they managed to maintain pace and agility, which they have? And it's not accident, and it's not, oh, well, they're just good at this stuff. It is, they have really thought about it, and they've written it down, and they said, this is how we are going to do it. And they have tools, heuristics, sort of ways of thinking and decision-making approaches that forced them into a way of achieving that level of agility. So we can't just say, oh, well, we'll become Amazon. Obviously, we can't. But equally, actually, some of those you can say, okay, let's just try that. Let's just do that and see if it works in our environment, and then tweak it in our environment. And yeah, it will take an organization that is a bit slow into one that's a bit faster. And that's all we're trying to achieve here.
Indeed. Well, that must be fascinating, of course, because we tend, in our upbringing, we've tended to believe that organizations, their agility and speed is inversely proportional to their growth and size. So Amazon, as you point out, has managed to keep that agility. And one might argue that it's displaying some monopolistic tendencies as well, which we don't have to get into. Amazon also reminds me of something else, which is the great contradiction, the hypocrisy that exists amongst fellow men here. That's a gender neutral term. And it's best described like this. Do you like the post office in the village? Yes. Do you like the corner shop in the village? Yes. Do you like the pub in the village? Do you like living in the village? Yes. Do you use them? No, I go to the big supermarket because it's cheaper. And in my experience, there are relatively few people who boycott the large mail order direct delivery organizations, because they may, on the one hand, criticize some of the practices and so on, but on the other hand, they want the benefit of the price, and the prices are, it's directly connected. Citing any organization here, this is just true of the local corner shop in any decent village, or the post office, where, frankly, people selfishly choose to go and do something else because it suits them personally, while campaigning to the other thing. And I think that defect in our makeup extends across into business, because on the one hand, we will, as managers say, I want to devolve this as far down the organization it will go. It's going to go all the way down through the organization. I'm going to have local decision making, and you'll all be in charge, and you'll be held accountable, and I'm going to devise the strategy. And then say, what do you mean you just spent X on a new car? And that's a terrible entrepreneurial managing defect, because arguably you ought not to know, but you do know because you like to keep a finger on the wheel, as it were. I guess some of this is behavioural, isn't it? It's not just structure, it's the behaviours of the people.
Almost the behaviours are far more important than the structure. And I will give you an example of this that I found absolutely seminal for me. It was one of those, oh, light bulb moments, you know, that you have in your career. I was at Chiltern Railways, and the MD of Chiltern Railways, a guy called Rob Brighouse, who's, yeah, I'd say probably the best boss I ever had, with meaning to imply that any of my other bosses weren't absolutely brilliant, because many of them were superb, but Rob really was absolutely fantastic. And I'll give you this example because it suddenly was so powerful. So we were building a new railway line from Oxford to London. I was commercial director, so I was responsible for revenue. And the way Chiltern Railways worked, as commercial director responsible for revenue, I was responsible for the customer experience design. Well, we therefore had some new stations we had to build. And so part of my job was to lead the specification of what these new stations would be like. I'd never specified a station before, you know, everything from floor to tiling to, you know, what the retail offer would look like to, you know, everything. And I formed a series of committees, you might say, meetings, you know, bringing together all the relevant people. And we literally brought everyone together. So we had the architect in the room, Network Rail in the room, the guy who was the new station manager who would be running these stations every day on the ground, project team, everyone with an interest in this. And we went through with the architect there and then in the room, and we basically designed these stations. And when there were things we couldn't decide there and then, someone went off and got the information, then we came back and we made decisions and we got on with it. Now, the point is that Rob knew that I was doing this and had absolute trust to let me do this. And I would be, if these stations didn't work, I was accountable for the fact they wouldn't work and it would be my head on the block. And what I suddenly had this extraordinary realization, and especially seeing how organizations like TfL tend to work, and I say this is not a criticism of TfL, it's very common. If Rob had said, oh, Thomas, can you, after the meeting, can you just give me a readout so I can check everything? It'd be very common. Immediately, the decision-making authority of that group that I had assembled would have drained away. Everyone would have known that actually Rob was going to make whatever decision he liked. He could overrule anything that happened. So what would the consequence of that be? One, fewer people would show up, so these meetings would be less effective. The decisions would go back to being having to bounce around by email, and it would be much slower. And two, because everyone knew that this was where the decisions were taken, as soon as we left the room, we'd had all the people in the room, they would go away and action it. So by the time of the next meeting, we'd made progress. Things had been built, And if this had been done, and that's just if Rob had said, oh, can I just have a check on it? But of course, imagine even more likely what would have happened in most organizations is we'd have got all those people in the room, we'd have made our recommendations, they would have been called, not decisions, they'd have been called recommendations. They would have then been put in a paper. That paper would have gone to a more senior group of people. But because those more senior group of people couldn't really be trusted to make the decision that we wanted them to make, we'd have had to wicket roll all of them first. We'd have to get time in all of their diaries. That would have taken a few months. Then they'd have had the review. They'd have felt the need to add value to the process by changing some of the things that we had recommended. So that would have then taken another iteration of our meeting to get blah, blah, blah. You can see where this goes. The point is that we would have a decision taken and being actioned the next day, a perfectly normal, totally typical process elsewhere, that same decision would have taken 6 months to make, totally normally.
Yep.
And it was only afterwards I thought, wow, that's how we got this done so fast. All of the structures, the JVs, all that stuff that we did very well, I would say, actually, most of it was just Rob not saying something that most bosses would have said.
Sure.
That's it. That's the key thing.
Yeah. Well, you've just reminded me a lesson I took with me to TfL, which I learned when I was in what is now the Department for Transport, but it was environment in those days. In such a hierarchical organization, when there was a paper to be written about something which goes about 4 or 5 grades below you, I used to insist on meeting the person who was going to do the first draft. Because otherwise what you find is by the time 4 people have passed this down, the first draft and the second draft and the third draft and fourth draft is bouncing around between grades 1, 2, 3, 2, 3, 4, 3, 2, 3, 4, as is being written and written and written and written. And almost certainly by the end of that process, it bears no resemblance whatsoever to the thing you actually wanted. So huge amounts of administrative time were wasted drawing up stuff that wasn't required. It was effectively the creative process being used in a hierarchical form. The right thing to do is to put all those people involved in a room and for them to thrash it out. The creative place and the drafting place are two quite different things. I found a lot of the delay was in people rejecting drafts and sending them back downwards. So progress upwards was very slow. And even when it finally did take place, it wasn't the thing that you wanted. So I made it a habit of insisting on meeting at least once the person who was going to hold the pen for the first go, to at least try and make sure that the thing originated roughly in the direction that you wanted it to go.
And I think that's such an important point, because when you look at organizations like Amazon, there's this view that you need to empower people and then get out of the way. And there's a huge element of truth there. But Amazon is not a democracy. It really isn't. Senior people make big decisions in Amazon. The point is that it's very, very clear when a decision needs to be made, it's made quickly. Then it's pushed straight down to the people who are doing the work. Get on with it. Make the decisions. As soon as you hit something where you can't make the decision, you go straight to the decision maker, the person who is at the top who needs to make the decision. And their side of the bargain is they'll make it.
Yes,
but
exactly.
It certainly doesn't mean that senior people just leave it to junior people to operate in a spirit of anarchy. It really doesn't.
So you mentioned AI, which I am absolutely fascinated about. I believe there is a point in people's, as they grow older, they reach a plateau beyond which they do not wish to go. So for some people, That's having an electric car. For some people, that is having a new mobile phone. And for others of us, I am so fascinated about the future. And since I have so little of it left to look forward to, I am gulping it down as quickly as possible. So you bet I've got iOS 18.1 on my iPhone since yesterday, because I can, because I want to know all the things it can do, because I'm fascinated by it all. I just did the keynote at an event called iMove in Brisbane, and this was at the Queensland University of Technology, a place, if I can describe it, that when you get off the bus, because you would use the bus to go to the university in Brisbane, because it's 50 cents for up to an hour's ride, and there is physical priority the whole way. So, of course, you're going to get the bus from the underground station, underground bus station, and then travel in tunnel and in segregated and arrive at the university 10 minutes and 50 cents later. Why
Fantastic.
Why would you do anything else? When you get to the university, I often find this. I found the same at Harvard when you visit. The air is bristling with a sort of static, which is the cumulative brain power of so many young people concentrated in such a small space. So you can actually feel in the air this amazing crackle of intelligence. And after I'd done my keynote, I was in the coffee shop. I was talking idly to this 19-year-old chap and some others, and learnt how to use AI to write, compose and perform music in 60 seconds. And in fact, if you go back and listen to the previous episode, Emma Hignett, that little theme tune about Emma was written by AI. It took about 60 seconds. It's got a front, it's got a bridge, it's got a chorus, and it's got an end. And is beautifully done, and comes with graphics and the words, and you can do all that. I was just fascinated that things are progressing now so quickly that this is becoming normal as well as free. And if that's happening in the sort of slightly leisure, it doesn't matter too much because we're just having fun market, just imagine what's going to happen in the place where it really matters. Like for decision making and for the creative development and for the freeing off of rubbish tasks and being replaced by more intelligent creative activity and so on, and will cause people to have new skills. So I am blown away by this development, and I'm clinging on as tightly as I can to it, on the grounds that it looks fascinating.
Well, the one that you and I, of course, need to be worried about is the product that is embedded within Google Notebook, which allows you to simply upload a book or a paper or a topic, and it will automatically generate an entirely realistic podcast with a host and a guest discussing the topic that you wish to be discussed. And at the end of it, everyone will think that two human beings got together for a lively and entertaining conversation, and in fact they didn't. So you and I in our respective worlds might be out of a job very shortly.
This is the truth. This is not fake news. This is Thomas and I discussing real news. We can prove it.
Well, I know I'm real. Leon, can you prove you're real?
Well, of course, we are into that existential debate, of course, aren't we? Am I the only person that exists, and is everything else just put on for my benefit? Because the only person I can prove exists is the sentient being that's me. And as far as I know, you could just be a machine. So could my family. So could all the people that I interact with. And this could be the Truman Show for all I know. So,
but I also think it would actually explain something, given the number of projects you seem to be managing at the same time, which I always find absolutely overwhelming. The idea that a whole series of AI Leon holograms have been created that are respectively flying around the world, attending events, investing in businesses, making decisions, and all the time, the real, well, which of us gets the real Leon?
The truth is out now, that's it.
That could be a monetization opportunity as well. You could charge a premium if the real Leon turns up, as opposed to one of your holograms.
Thank you. Well, let's just take as a working assumption you and I are both real for the purpose of at least this discussion, because otherwise we'll spend another half an hour off on that. So on the working assumption you and I are both real.
I should, by the way, just your crackle of intelligence. I've really seen that. I've been renting a WeWork office in Aldwych since September. And immediately behind it is the LSE, which has this extraordinary campus that isn't a campus, centered around the old curiosity shop. And if you didn't know it was there, it's hidden down an alleyway off the Aldwych. And as soon as you walk in, you get exactly the same atmosphere, just lots of very bright people thinking interesting thoughts. It's a great place to wander through, which I do quite regularly. But the point about the change in air is it's so critical that we're thinking about this now. And I think one of the reasons why people sometimes struggle to realize how fast things are changing is there's a great quote from Mustafa Suleiman. And he's the guy who co-founded DeepMind, which has been at the driving force of all of these AI innovations, which he founded in London and the King's Cross, sold it to Google in 2014. He then headed up Google's AI capability for many years. Google, of course, developed the transformer technology, which powers things like ChatGPT. He, by the way, started his career at the GLA, which is absolutely remarkable. And there's a great quote in his book in which he says that AI is all the things computers can't yet do. Anything it already can do is just software. And that's absolutely true, because we encounter AI so often nowadays in our daily activities. But as soon as we just get used to it, it just happens. It's just what the computers can do. And therefore we forget how much has already changed and how close we are to the next set of changes. And opportunities and threats for our sector. One of the things I think we really need to be ready for is the fact that tools like ChatGPT and all of the rest are building on the things that have been happening for many years around autocorrect and autocomplete and all of that stuff, which means that very soon communicating with organizations will just be instant and effortless. A system will know that you were on a train and it was delayed, and who you bought it from and what ticket it was and what happened. And your AI will automatically fill in whatever forms need to be filled in, send whatever emails need to be sent to whomsoever they need to be sent, in order to ensure that you're always getting exactly the compensation you're entitled to. And at the moment, there's a slight kind of bargain in the industry that people are told about their rights enough to show that they're being told about their rights, but with an assumption that not everyone will actually execute against those. And if everyone automatically can, and it's not a human who's doing it, it's just people's AIs that have been told once, go and claim whatever I'm entitled to, and they do it, we're going to get a tsunami of people coming and talking to us. And they won't be people, they'll be AIs, but acting as agents of our customers that we need to be ready to respond to. And it sounds dystopian, but realistically, in a few years' time, the volume of that communications from our customers' AIs, the only way we're going to be able to do that is to make sure we've got our own AIs ready to respond to them. And if we don't, we're going to be swamped.
Indeed. So, but it will require a completely different view on life. And in fact, on this very show, I had the debate with Christian Wolmar, who is a big skeptic for autonomous vehicles. And one of the reasons for that skepticism is how they cope on narrow, congested old city type roads. But of course, you have to rethink the whole concept itself. I mean, frankly, if you think about autonomous vehicles being four wheels and tires on a bit of dedicated carriageway separated from everybody else, thinking takes you in one direction. But on the other hand, as is shown at airports, it's actually possible to mix small vehicles and people, and indeed luggage trolleys, all in the same space. You could see a situation where your autonomous vehicle might take you into Selfridges rather than drop you outside it. Because it's only because you're thinking of a four-seater or five-seater vehicle being driven autonomously that you end up with the troubles of what happens if you end up nose-to-nose in a narrow street in the City of London somewhere. So it does force you to think about a whole different way of the retail experience, the way in which business decisions are made, and so on. So I think, as is always the case, and it's one of the reasons why you can only listen sparingly to radio phone-ins, people take the future and superimpose it on the present and explain why it won't work. But in fact, the future will be superimposed on a different sort of future, and we have to make that change in order for the progress to be made at all. Am I making sense, Thomas?
Yeah, no, absolutely right. And of course, actually, the Silicon Valley types are as guilty of this as everyone else, because one of the reasons why I think Christian is, I understand his skepticism about autonomous vehicles, is the fact that the standard that's always been set by the promoters of that technology has been, I want something that looks, acts, and feels like a car, but it drives itself, because they emerge from the auto-centric culture of the United States. And that's where the technology has largely been developed, and that's where the money has largely come from. And achieving a car that can go anywhere autonomously, without support, without killing lots of people, is very, very hard. And the only real solution to this is the one that Elon Musk has developed, which is to say, well, screw it, we'll just put it out and let it learn on the job and hope for the best.
Indeed.
Which is a somewhat unethical approach, but it is actually, from a point of view of enabling this technology to learn, refine and improve, it's probably the only way to make this work. But of course, you know, if you're looking at what autonomous technology can be used for, and you don't assuming it needs to be a car, you've suddenly got this extraordinary potential in the world of public transport. Why do people not use public transport? And let's face it, you know, I live in a place where people do. I live in London, and I live in a part of London that's got the underground, and not just the underground, the Victoria line. So, you know, round here, public transport is pretty well used. But in the world, in the United Kingdom as a whole, public transport is a minority sport because, bluntly, it's too expensive and it's not good enough. And the reason for that, it's very expensive to deploy something into a place with low population densities. If you've got something that's electric and driverless, it suddenly becomes very cheap to deploy that. Same thing. I mean, it's just really simple. And it doesn't have to go everywhere. It doesn't have to have level 5 capability, as it's known in the industry. It just needs to be able to keep going on a defined route, like a bus. And if it encounters problems, well, it has an operations center like transport always has done. So suddenly you've got something that can be autonomous to an extent, low cost. If it's low cost, it can be high frequency. Something that's high frequency is attractive. That's, you know, one of the key drivers of public transport demand. Suddenly the number of places that we could connect into the public transport network is absolutely phenomenal. But this isn't a vehicle that's a bus, nor is it a car. It's something that we don't really have at the moment. And it's not saying we're going to take the number 73 bus and take the driver off it. We're not going to do that. Even if the thing does drive itself in the future, we're still going to have someone on it, like we do on the DLR, like we do on the Victoria line, like we do on the Central line. But what we can have is vastly, and I mean vastly, increased connectivity, which will transform the whole economics of the public transport network, because it becomes a kind of reverse beaching cuts, where the more places you can plug back in, the more the network becomes stronger as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Extraordinary, extraordinary. Well, you're talking to somebody who took a Waymo in San Francisco last month. And by the way, the driverless Waymo was far calmer and certainly safer than the rather excitable human driver I had from the airport, who insisted on shouting, using the horn and being in every lane sequentially. and I commend it. Thomas, it's been fantastic to talk to you. We could carry on forever. And indeed, we probably will, but not necessarily on air. But I've been delighted to have Thomas Abelman as my guest. You can find out more about what he is doing at freewheeling.info. Take yourself across to his website and find out more about what he's doing in his world. So, Thomas, thank you very much indeed, especially for joining us. This has been Lunch with Leon, which is a podcast in association with Passenger Transport Magazine. Very grateful to them for continuing to support this podcast, and Thomas for being a rare example of somebody who's been on this podcast twice, and indeed on yours as well. All the luck with everything that you're doing, and I guess we'll catch up very soon.
I hope so. See you soon. It's been great fun as always.
Thomas, he's a name, you know, freewheeling, taking companies to the flow. He turns hurdles into stepping stones, changing the world wherever he goes. Freedom to move, reinvent to grow, agility's the key, but watch it show. Thomas leads the charge with tests, like a breeze that goes. He lifts you up, never lets you fall. Freedom to move, reinvent to grow. Agility's the key, watch it show. Thomas leads the charge with zest. Freewheeling, helping you be the best.